Welcome, this is Marcia for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading National Geographic magazine, dated July 2022. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the first article, titled, Why We Should Spare Parasites, by Erica Engelhaupt. Some are harmful, invasive, creepy, but parasites balance ecosystems, and killing them off could doom the planet. Growing up, Chelsea Wood dreamed of becoming a marine biologist and studying sharks or dolphins, the kind of big, exciting animals that biologists call charismatic megafauna. Instead, during a college internship, she found herself peering through a microscope at the innards of a snail. As a kid, she had often plucked these periwinkles off rocks along the Long Island shores and collected them in buckets, but she had never looked inside one. So she cracked a snail open, and under magnification she saw thousands of little white sausage-shaped things, dumplings, out of the snail's body. The sausages were larvae of the flatworm Cryptococcal lingua, a common fish parasite. Seen through the microscope, they each had two dark eye spots, which made them surprisingly cute and charming. I couldn't believe that I'd been looking at snails for as long as I had and missing all the cool stuff happening inside them, says Wood, who now studies parasites at the University of Washington. I just totally fell in love with them. I like to say that they got under my skin. Wood has since become a leader in a new conservation movement that aims to save the world's uncharismatic minifauna. Nearly half of all known animals are parasites, Wood says. One study projects that a tenth of them may be doomed to extinction in the next 50 years because of climate change, loss of their hosts, and deliberate attempts at eradication. Other estimates suggest that up to a third could disappear. Right now, though, it seems few people care or even notice. Of the more than 40,000 species flagged as threatened on the IUCN Red List, nearly a handful are parasites. Parasites are the pariahs of the animal world because at some point in their lives they live in or on a host and take something from that host. But most parasites have evolved not to kill their hosts, and not all of them even cause noticeable harm. What's more, only a small percentage affect humans. Scientists warn of dire consequences if we continue to ignore the plight of parasites. Not only are some of them useful to humans, such as medicinal leeches, still employed in some surgeries, but we're also starting to understand that they play crucial roles in ecosystems, keeping some populations in check while helping feed others. Some experts say there's an aesthetic argument for saving them, too. If you get past the ick factor and get to know them, you may find parasites' pluckiness eerily charming. They've evolved ingenious means of survival, from the crustacean that becomes a fish's tongue to the jewel wasp that controls the minds of cockroaches. People think of parasites as gross and slimy and flaccid and wiggling, and that's true some of the time, Wood says. But if you look at them under the microscope, they are just staggeringly beautiful. Parasitism has evolved as a way of life again and again over billions of years, from the smallest, simplest microbes to the most complex vertebrates. There are parasitic plants, parasitic birds, a bewildering array of parasitic worms and insects, and even a parasitic mammal, the vampire bat, which survives by drinking the blood of cows and other mammals. Of the 42 major branches on the tree of life, called phyla, 31 are mostly parasites. Yet we've barely begun to identify all the parasites, much less learn their lifestyles or monitor their populations. That's just not something that we've ever really prioritized, says Skylar Hopkins, an ecologist at North Carolina State University. So a few years ago, Hopkins pulled together a group of scientists interested in parasite conservation, and they started sharing what they knew. In 2020, they published the first-ever global plan for saving parasites in the journal Biological Conservation. One of the problems is what's called the paradox of coextinction. Since parasites, by definition, rely on other species, they're particularly vulnerable. Take, for example, the endangered pygmy hog-sucking louse. It lives only on another endangered species, the pygmy hog, which is disappearing from the grasslands it inhabits in the foothills of the Himalaya. Then there's the California condor louse, which became the unofficial poster child for parasitic conservation through an iconic twist of fate. In the 1970s, desperate to save the California condor, biologists began raising the birds in captivity. Part of the protocol was to de-louse every bird with pesticides on the assumption that parasites were bad for condors, though it's not clear if they actually were. The California condor louse hasn't been seen since. Similarly, the New England medicinal leech, hasn't been sighted for more than a decade, and overfishing has probably done in the marine fluke Stichocotyle nephroprase, which depended on rays and skates. Untold other parasitic worms, protozoans, and insects are presumed to have gone down with the ship, so to speak, as their hosts died out. While the demise of life's hangers-on might seem like no big deal, or even something to strive for, ecologists caution that wiping them all out would probably spell planetary doom. Without parasites keeping them in check, populations of some animals would explode, just as invasive species do when they're transplanted away from natural predators. Other species likely would crash in the ensuing melee. Big, charismatic predators would lose out, too. Many parasites have evolved to move into their next host by manipulating the host they're in, which tends to drive that host into a predator's mouth. Nematomorph worms, for example, mature inside crickets, but then need to get to water to mate. So they influence the crickets' brains, driving the insects to jump into streams, where they become an important food source for trout. Similar phenomena feed birds, cats, and other predators the world over. Even human health wouldn't entirely benefit from wiping out parasites. In countries such as the United States, where we have eliminated most intestinal parasites, we have autoimmune diseases that are virtually unheard of in places where everyone still has those parasites. According to one line of thinking, the human immune system evolved with a coterie of worms and protozoan parasites, and when we killed them off, our immune systems began attacking ourselves. Some people with Crohn's disease have even purposefully infected themselves with intestinal worms to try to restore their gut's ecological balance, with mixed results. That said, scientists aren't eager to save all parasites. The guinea worm, for instance, gets a hard pass from even hardcore conservationists. It grows to adulthood inside a person's abdomen, often reaching several feet long, then travels to the leg and emerges painfully through the foot. Former President Jimmy Carter's foundation has set out to drive the worm to extinction, and few will miss it. If anyone would want to get rid of all parasites, you'd think it would be Bobby Pritt. As medical director for the Mayo Clinic's Human Parasitology Lab, Pritt identifies parasites found all over the country and in every body part. In a typical day, she may work with blood-carrying malaria parasites, brain tissue full of Toxoplasma gondii, or toe scrapings with sand fleas picked up by walking barefoot on the beach. Yet even Pritt has a soft spot for parasites. She writes a blog called Creepy, Dreadful, Wonderful Parasites and spends weekends studying the ticks outside her vacation cabin. As a physician, she favors eradicating parasites in places where they cause disease and suffering. But as a biologist, she says, the idea of actually going out and purposefully trying to make something extinct just doesn't sit well with me. Ultimately, the goal of conserving parasites isn't to make everyone love them. It's just to call a detente in our war against all of them, because there's still so much we don't understand. A stroll and a meal. For a classic example of ghoulish parasitism, consider the jewel wasp, Ampulex compressa. The female of the species has a devious strategy. She will sting a cockroach in the head, then lead the zombie roach to a burrow by its antenna, like a dog on a leash. There, the wasp lays an egg on the roach and buries them together. The roach becomes her larva's first meal. Parasites by the numbers. When we humans gaze across an African savanna or Australian coral reef, we notice lions and zebras and colorful fish. But those animals are the homes for most of the life hidden in front of us. All told, 40% of known animals are parasites, and that's just the species that have been described. Scientists think that's only about 10% of all the parasites out there, leaving potentially millions more to be discovered. In terms of species diversity, parasitic wasps alone probably outnumber any other group of animals, even beetles. Most species, it turns out, are parasitized by multiple others. Take humans. Despite our efforts to be inhospitable, we're excellent hosts. More than 100 different parasites have evolved to live in or on us, many now dependent on us for their species existence. So when you look at a plant or animal, think about all the parasites that might be living on or inside, silent and unseen. After all, there's a reason they're so common. Nature abhors a vacuum, says Chelsea Wood, a parasite ecologist. If there's an opportunity, someone's going to evolve to fill it. The next article, Diving Under the Pyramids, by Nicole Sobecki. I could feel myself suffocating. Each step down the bedrock passageway brought me closer to what I'd long imagined, the pool of khaki water, the flooded tunnel it hid, and the moment I'd have to enter that darkness. The crumbling grandeur of a pyramid loomed above. Here at the ancient necropolis of Nuri in Sudan's northern desert, Kushite royals were laid to rest millennia ago in a series of underground burial chambers beneath mighty pyramids. Now the chambers were flooded with groundwater leaching from the nearby Nile. Archaeologist Pierce Paul Creisman, funded in part by a National Geographic Society grant, was leading a team that would be the first to attempt underwater archaeology below a pyramid. Initially, I'd been calm, even excited, about going along to photograph this ambitious and risky effort in 2020. But as I walked deeper underground, my heart raced and I could barely breathe. I'd known this existential anxiety before. 9 years ago, from crouching in a drainage pipe in Libya as belt-fed machine guns peppered the ground above. 7 years ago, under attack by Al-Shabaab terrorists in a shopping mall in Nairobi, as pop music eerily played on. 4 years ago, on a lawless beach in Somalia. Here, there was no outward enemy, but something in my own mind screaming at me, "Do not descend." Creisman and dive master Justin Schneider saw my concern. "Give me a moment," I said. Holding tightly to my camera, a weight belt slung across my chest, I bit into my regulator and sank cross-legged below the waterline. "Breathe, just breathe." Surfacing, I nodded to my companions. I was ready. We descended, funneling ourselves through a narrow chute and down into the disorienting blackness. Every culture of the world has death traditions to ease the passage of loved ones into the next life and soothe those left behind in this one. This 2,300-year-old tomb was the resting place of Nastasen, a king who led Kush for roughly two decades. Before him, several of the Kushite kings, known as Black Pharaohs, became so powerful that they ruled all of Nubia and Egypt. Nastasen was the last of them to be buried at Nuri, before threats from rivals forced the Kush to move their capital south. They left behind extraordinary temples, pyramids, and their interred pharaohs. Excavating Nuri with its treasures hidden underwater was an especially formidable challenge. A century ago, Harvard Egyptologist George Reisner visited Nuri to explore, among others, the burial chambers of King Taharqa, who ruled all of Egypt in the 7th century BC, and even earned a mention in the Old Testament for rallying his troops to defend Jerusalem. Many of the other Nuri tombs, though, were left unexplored. The waters have since risen higher, influenced by climate change, the growing agricultural needs of the area, and the modern dams that are transforming the Nile. Since Creisman's work began, Sudan has experienced a coup, a global pandemic, record-setting floods, and a 2019 revolution. When protesters toppled the 30-year dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir, whose government tried to erase Sudan's pre-Islamic history. They chanted the names of Nubian royals. My grandfather is Taharqa. My grandmother is a Kandaka queen. Bashir is now facing charges at the International Criminal Court. Protesters in the streets denounce the military that grabbed power and sabotaged the country's democratic transition. History long submerged has begun to surface. I swam through a dark channel into the tomb's chambers. Clouds of sediment obstructed all visibility, and despite the small space, it was shockingly easy to get lost and find myself swimming in circles. A hand connected with mine, and we emerged into the second chamber, where the collapsed ceiling resulted in a welcome air pocket. My flashlight work began. Traditional dirt excavation skills were useless here, so Kreisman's team had to develop new techniques, often on the fly, to uncover the secrets of this overlooked kingdom. Underwater archaeology is now a specialized field, but in its early days, the skills and tools were adapted from shipwreck salvagers and rarely had been used in such tight confines. No room for bulky scuba tanks either, obviously. We breathed instead through sunshine yellow hoses that ran back the way we entered, connecting us to the air above. The risk of a cave-in couldn't be absolutely eliminated, but the entrance was reinforced with 50 linear feet of steel beams, and risk was just not talked about much. Team members looked for anything of interest, gold leaf, figurines, pottery, and noted their findings with waterproof boards and markers. A thin cord ran from the third and final burial chamber to the world above, our guide through the darkness. The work acquired a rhythm. Kreisman would descend into the final chamber, which held what might have been Nastassen's unopened sarcophagus. A few minutes later, he'd return with a filled bucket. It would be carried outside to team members, who'd examine and sort its contents. About an hour into this routine, Kreisman surfaced in the second chamber, took a breath, and called out, "Shabti!" He tenderly lifted the funerary figurine for us to see. Gazing at it in his palm, I realized my breath had slowed to normal and my mind had cleared. The carved man was broken down the middle, but retained his dignified, dutiful expression. He looked ready to fulfill his destiny. Thousands of years ago, a span so long, I can't really fathom it. The figures were believed to revive in order to serve their masters in the afterlife. Now here I was, in the underworld with them. My fear washed away and awe flooded in. In my line of work, I've had a few opportunities like this, to experience an ancient marvel as most people never will, and to photograph it for the world to see. I focused on the glistening wet Shabti. The camera shutter blinked, making the ephemeral permanent. Nastassen had rested here in darkness for 2 millennia, kept company by hundreds of tiny caretakers. Soon I'd return to the world above ground, with its impossibly blue skies. But not yet. First, I shot frame after frame, freezing this place in time and willing myself to remember those things beyond my ability to capture. In the next article, we are here. North America's indigenous nations are reclaiming their sovereignty, control of their land, laws, and how they lived, by Charles C. Mann. Quenot Rose Chakara, a groundbreaking indigenous model, uses her fame to support her activism, reminding people whose land you're living on. Native sovereignty, she says, is key to defending my ways of life, trying to protect what's left. She is Han Guijin and Sinkangu Ogala Lakota, but was born on Diné Navajo land in Arizona. Here she stands, a park administered by the Diné amongst her background. Chapter 1, Reclaiming the Land. The block of red cedar was about 6 feet long and 3 feet high and almost as wide. Gordon Dick was slicing off its rounded top. The chainsaw bit into it, spraying sawdust. Noise-canceling headphones on, Joe Martin crouched to watch where the blade poked through. With his right hand, he made little signals, up a bit, down, good. The air filled with a sharp, almost medicinal scent of cedar. Martin is a Tlaoqui Ott artist on the west coast of Vancouver Island in British Columbia. Dick, another carver, is from the Tsleil-Waututh, a neighboring nation. They were making the first rough cuts on a statue of a wolf sitting on its haunches, a short totem pole in effect. Nearby were two larger poles, almost complete, 24 feet and 30 feet tall. Up one side of each pole, stacked atop each other, were symbolic figures, bears, suns, mythical sea serpents, more wolves. This summer, Martin will erect one of the poles in his family's home village of Opeachsot on Mieres Island, near the Vancouver Island resort town of Tofino. Opeachsot had hundreds until an 1884 Canadian law forced native peoples to let collectors and museums freely take them, which they did. Like stained glass windows in cathedrals, totem poles are visual representations of traditional teachings, but their imposing presence makes them more than that, Martin told me. They say, "We are here. This is our space." Mieres Island is part of the Tlaoqueatl homeland. So are Tofino and scores of islands in Clayoquot Sound. Clayoquot is an older spelling of the nation's name. Canada says these 400 square miles are a mix of national park, provincial timber zones, and private land, with a few tiny native village sites. But the Tlaoqueatl say it's all their territory and always has been. They have declared the entire area to be tribal parks. Much of the area has been logged badly by firms that stripped the country of its valuable ancient cedar and created erosion and ruin. They came and left, says Saya Maso, head of the Tlaoqueatl Natural Resources Department. That was 50 years ago, and they didn't restore the land, and neither did British Columbia or Canada, so we're doing it. The Tlaoqueatl are rechanneling streams, recreating the pre-logging ecosystem, protecting herring spawning areas, and blockading logging roads in delicate spots where visitors shouldn't go. On top of the conservation work, they are beginning the tedious but vital business of nation building, starting their own education programs, hiring their own rangers, known as park guardians, and possibly, most important, persuading businesses to add something akin to a sales tax, a voluntary 1% surcharge, to their customers' bills to support the nation's endeavors. When Native people talk about this work, they often use the word sovereignty. Typically, sovereignty means self-rule, but people like Maso and Martin mean more than that by the term. It stands for a vision of Native societies as autonomous cultures, part of the modern world but rooted in their own long-standing values, working as equal partners with non-tribal governments at every level. The closest English term that I know to what we mean by sovereignty is self-actualization, said Leroy Littlebear of the Kainai Blood. An emeritus law professor at the University of Lethbridge, Littlebear played a key role in the enshrinement of Indigenous rights in the Canadian Constitution in 1982. Sovereignty is having access to all of ourselves. The Tlaoqueatl are not alone or even exceptional. All over Turtle Island, a common Indigenous name for North America, from origin stories about the world being atop a turtle shell, its original inhabitants are reclaiming a status that they have never surrendered and, in the process, are changing their own lives and those of their neighbors. And perhaps most remarkable, they have gained a measure of acceptance from the non-tribal world. The efforts range from tribal police in Montana successfully defending their right to detain non-natives whom they suspect of committing crimes on their lands, to boards in Canada that take input from Indigenous and government representatives and jointly oversee environmental issues across nearly 1.7 million square miles, about 40% of the country. Most of this work is small scale, almost under the radar, such as the collaboration among the Nakoda, Assiniboine, the Anangi, Gros Ventre, and the U.S. Bureau of Land Management to restore prairie land in Montana. But some of it has thunderous impact, like the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2020 that led lower courts to affirm nearly half of Oklahoma is native land. Much as African American activists pushed civil rights through litigation and legislation that built incrementally, Native nations have pushed to regain sovereignty methodically, one lawsuit, one negotiation, one law, one program at a time. For decades, the Tla'oqui'at protested that they had never signed a treaty with British Columbia, and thus had given up none of their rights or land. Until 1993, the province refused even to negotiate. Only in October of last year, after 19 years of talks and several side agreements, did it agree to a framework for discussions. The process has been grindingly slow, but the change is as undeniable as the roadside sign that greets visitors entering tribal territory. Tla'oqui'at har haldi, Tla'oqui'at homeland. None of this is foreordained to continue. More than 42% of the officially recognized tribes in the United States have no federally or state-recognized reservation, and the reservations of tribes that possess them are a tiny fraction of what they had in the past. Native peoples are among the poorest and unhealthiest on the continent, with some of the highest rates of drug overdose deaths of any racial or ethnic group. Indigenous women in particular face violence at horrific rates. Most worrisome for activists, the U.S. and Canadian governments retain the power to dismantle Native victories at any time. When I asked Saya Maso what he hoped to see in 5 or 10 years, he gave me a list: improved health care, a museum and cultural center, a tribal longhouse to replace the one destroyed in the 19th century, a bigger, higher-paid parks guardian force, better sewage treatment, an entire Tla'oqui'at school system. The key to all that is building the tribal economic base, he said, and the root of doing that is sovereignty, nation to nation. The world doesn't know we're equal, he said, but we're getting better at telling them. Let the games begin. The first time I tried to use the Ishtaboli sticks was at the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma's Labor Day Festival, the biggest official gathering of the Chata, as they call themselves, held in Tuskahoma, the nation's capital. It's in some ways like any county fair, and in some ways not. One of the biggest knots is Ishtaboli, a team sport older than any played by their colonizers. Ishtaboli is called stickball in English. This concludes readings from National Geographic magazine for today. Your reader has been Marcia. If you've enjoyed hearing this content, please give us a call at 859-422-6390. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.